Hi, it's Duncan here, and as you're about to find out, the Honourable James Shaw reveals some fantastic life lessons, one of which was the importance of martial arts. Now, I took this advice to heart pretty seriously, and after the interview, asked him if he would teach me some yoga. Long story long, he said yes, and before I knew it, we were doing the splits. No, I'm just kidding. We weren't doing the splits, but something that was almost splitting was my pants. Wow. It was a tough exercise. Head over to the Mountain Climbers Podcast on Facebook to see what happened. Today on the Mountain Climbers Podcast, he's Aotearoa New Zealand's Minister for Climate Change, Associate Minister for the Environment, and co-leader of the Green Party. The Honourable James Shaw takes the hot seat.
What do you procrastinate about?
I got my full driver's license last week.
What?
Yeah, I procrastinated about that for 25 years.
We talk weakness.
One of the things that people say is, oh, you know, I could never go into politics because all the crap that you guys have to take. Actually, you don't.
Negotiating differing points of view and, of course, his greatest life lessons. The Mountain Climbers Podcast starts now.
Everybody, and welcome to the Mountain Climbers Podcast. It's great to be with you. And James, Mr. Minister, sorry, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
As someone in the public eye, you know, in politics, there's a lot of things for us who aren't in the public eye that would take for granted, like going and doing the shopping or seeing a car mechanic. And I just thought it'd be interesting to hear what it would be like to do those everyday mundane tasks for someone like you.
I don't get to do them as much as I used to, but it is one of the weird things about adjusting, about the transition into politics, and actually particularly into government, because obviously you've got a lot higher profile in government than you do when you're in opposition. I was down at New World the other day, you know, just doing the weekly shopping, and it takes longer because you do kind of stop and have conversations. But I guess one of the things that people say is, oh, you know, I could never go into politics because, you know, all the crap that you guys have to take, and, you know, you've got people harassing you all the time. Actually, you don't.
Really?
You don't. And
what?
In those conversations, you know, on the street or at the supermarket or wherever it is, generally people are, universally, except for one fairly notable incident, people are really polite, and they're curious, and they just want to have a conversation, you know. So I had a guy, a farmer, come up to me at Auckland Airport, you know, just waiting for an aeroplane, and he was waiting for his. And, you know, he's pretty worried about the effect of climate change policy on his farm and on farming practice and on his community, and sort of was testing some of the things that I had said. But he was, you know, it was a very genuine conversation, right? He was skeptical but not hostile. And that's kind of as tough as it gets.
Really? Because online, when you look at it just from an online perspective, that is quite a hostile environment, do you think? Or is that the same as well for you?
Yeah, no, I think social media is a septic tank, and anti-social media, as we call it around the office. And actually, I engage a lot less now than I used to. And I don't know if that's a function of the fact that my job has changed or if the tone of it has changed.
Of social media.
Yeah, that's right.
So, okay.
For example, I've been on Twitter for about 10 years. You know, I was sort of, you know, pretty much not long after Twitter had started as a platform. And my memory, and I haven't changed who I've, I mean, I've added people who I'm following, but I haven't, you know, dumped a lot of the people I was following earlier. And, you know, it was hilarious, right? It was just this really kind of bantery, interesting kind of community, where it was like walking into a crowded room and, you know, with all these conversations going on and kind of dipping in and out and kind of participating in the ones that you thought were a bit funny. And it sort of had the tone of everyone's had one drink but not six, you know. And now it's kind of like ugly drunk, is the kind of general tone of things. And I think part of that has been driven by actually the, you know, the professionalization of it, and people now using data to kind of work out what's going to get the strongest reaction. And it's the, frankly, it's the dark stuff. And so let's kind of drive that because that's going to get the clicks and the, you know, the followership. And I hate it.
And do you think that, you know, do you think you have to have a hard skin to be in politics?
You know, it's funny. I don't think people say that I must have a really tough hide, right? And I don't relate to that. It's more like,
do you have a thick skin?
I don't think so. I don't think I'm thin-skinned, right? I don't think I'm terribly defensive or anything like that. But I don't think of myself as insensitive. Like, I associate having a thick skin with a sort of insensitivity or even a bit of a tin ear, you know? And there are certainly politicians who are like that. But I just kind of think, well, that's all just... Okay, here's the way I relate to it. When someone kind of has a go, in many ways that says more about them than it does about me, right? That, you know, that's just someone kind of sharing their opinion and how they think. Now, I have a choice about whether to engage with that or not. And for me, it's like, is it useful to engage with that? Well, you know, most
maybe,
of the time,
maybe not.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So for someone looking to develop that in a time of confrontation, what advice would you give to them?
Two things. I mean, first of all, is just remember that when someone is being nasty, it's them that's being nasty, right? Mm. When someone says something about you, they're actually talking about themselves. And so only you have the choice of interpreting how you think about yourself, you know? You know, and every time, you know, I mean, people do say stuff every now and then, and it kind of it gets through, and I'm like, oh. But... I think that's a pretty important lesson, is because, frankly, in politics, you know, you're dealing with thousands of people, especially now with social media, like tens of thousands of people. You cannot allow yourself to be shaped by
every comment.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have seen people who have allowed that, and it doesn't end well for them. So that would be the first thing. Now, the second thing, this is going to sound a bit strange, if you're into something like jiu-jitsu or aikido, you know, or karate or something like that, there's a really healthy approach to how you engage in conflict. And New Zealanders, for the most part, are terrible at it. Like, we're some of the world's worst conflict avoiders. So we don't develop a maturity in handling it. And then... we kind of allow ourselves to get into these situations, gets to a point, and then we just kind of blow up, right? So nothing forever, and that sort of doesn't really work terribly well. And so one of the things that I believe is that, you know, working with an opponent whose job it is to improve your performance is actually quite a good analogy for how we handle, you know, how we deal in politics and in an environment which is built on a principle of conflict.
So why martial arts?
It's that point of that you're facing an opposition, you cannot get good at what you're doing without that opposition. Mm. And the better your opposition, the better you are called to be. To me, that, you know, actually respecting that and working with that. And so when, you know, someone's coming at you, it's kind of like, okay, you know, again, it's like, how do I choose to respond to this? How do I improve what I'm doing as a result of what's going on here? Not in a sort of a, you know, I'm going to beat you into the dust kind of thing, but actually that it's about me, right?
Yeah, and keeping the attention on what's important and your response focusing all on you.
It is, yeah. And there is a sort of a, you know, I mean, in politics, it's a verbal thing, right? I mean, it's all about kind of speeches and questions in the House and, you know, all kind of stuff. And yet the reaction that we have is a physiological reaction, right? It is still a, you know, a contest in a contestable environment. And so the great thing about, you know, those sort of either team sports or the or those kind of martial art style things, is that you develop a physiological way of handling the situation. And so when someone's coming at you in a different environment, which isn't, it's outside the kind of domain of whatever sport you practice, your body actually reacts to the stress and to the situation in the same way as it would in that other environment. So that kind of practice, I think, really
it
helps.
It is super transferable.
That's right. It's a very mind-body discipline, if you like.
And speaking of conflict as well, you're the leader of one of the largest parties in New Zealand. When there are differing points of view within your party, how do you negotiate which one comes out on top and which to go with?
When you say when there are, that is every day, right? And one of the things that I say is that two or more people is a political situation, right? Because everyone, even if we're cut from the same cloth generally in kind of political philosophy terms, we will have differences of opinion about, you know,
somewhere
along the line. And one of the most fascinating things about the political environment, and it really is fascinating, is that you have, every day 12 things, completely different issues, some of which are social, some of which are economic, some of which are environmental. And so every day there is, differences of opinion about every single one of those things. And you've got to get a group of people onto the same page. And then ideally, you kind of want all of Parliament to get onto the same page or something akin to it. And so that is one of the most fascinating parts of the whole kind of process. For the Green Party, we've always had this attachment to consensus-based decision making, as opposed to generally in politics, it's a sort of voting-based system. So the majority wins all the time, and because the Greens are one of our kind of core principles and values, if you like, is inclusion, particularly of excluded minorities or systemically excluded minorities. If you just have a 50% plus one vote rule for every decision, then every single time your excluded minority continues to be excluded, right? Because the majority vote goes against them all the time. And so the principle of consensus-based decision making isn't the same as unanimity. Doesn't say that you and I need to agree 100%, but what it means, and this is where the word consent comes through, which is like, even if I disagree with you, that I will consent to the decision to go forward because my concerns have been taken on board and dealt with to a degree that I am comfortable to allow it to occur. And so so what that means is that in order to get to that point, you need to have, and it's a really long and quite a torturous decision-making process and doesn't always fit well in the fast-paced environment of politics, but it's a pretty rigorous process where you do kind of basically sit in the conversation and say, okay, first of all, where are people at? Turns out that there
the
are
the majority of people.
No,
you
no,
look the, at the majority
no,
at that point?
No, you start with everyone and you say this in like a straw poll situation. If we were to make this decision, would anybody object? Oh, okay, there are some objections. There could be as few as one objection. Okay, what's that objection? Is there a way that we can address that? And so then you kind of work through that until you get to the point where it's like, okay, does that objection still exist? Okay, it does still exist. Is the objection so strong that you would block the decision, as it stands? And if the answer is yes, then one of two things can happen. You either then downgrade to a vote, but you have a higher threshold than just 50%. Or you kind of, if you've got the time and ability, you can go, okay, well, is there something else that we can do to try and overcome that objection? So it's just there's a decision-making process that generally gets you to the point where, although it may be pretty torturous to get there, that you've got that group of people sufficiently bought in to it that when it then goes public or the decision's made and so on and so forth, everyone stands behind you and goes, yep, yep.
So are there other parties who don't do that and who the leader just charges forward
with?
No
other party does that.
No other party?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. So there's a bit of a spectrum, right? We're kind of at one extreme with that. Probably National would be at the other end. They're a much more hierarchical organisation. And the way that they, they predate us by several decades as well. So in many ways, their organisational practices sort of started, you know, at an earlier time. And so the way that they handle the conflict is that they've got an organisational culture that says, well, if the vote goes against you, too bad, you just suck it up, right? Mm-hmm. I tend to think that that leads to greater levels of conflict because there's this sort of simmering undercurrent of unresolved stuff that needs to get dealt with. You can see a little bit of that about that in their kind of behaviour at the moment. And then somewhere in the middle between those two extremes, you've got Labour, you know, where like National, they started a long time ago, so they're kind of used to that majoritarian decision making. But I guess because they came from the Labour movement, which was actually at the time it was about, you know, trying to take a group of people who were sort of at the bottom of the heap and kind of fight their way into the system, that they've got a bit more of that. And then we came along a bit later and it was another evolution.
Mm. Does that though imply that National and Labour aren't evolving with the times?
No, they do. I mean, every party changes, you know. We're not the same party as Jeanette Fitzsimons' party of the 1990s. This National Party is certainly not Jim Bolger's National Party, and they're certainly not Rob Muldoon's National Party. I mean, they're about as far away from that as you can imagine. But, you know, organisations do tend to hold on to their kind of earlier, when they were founded, they, you know, those kind of institutions and those organisational cultures tend to get fairly well hardwired into the organisation, and they do tend to carry through time.
Mm. All right. What advice would you give to someone, a young person who wants to get into politics?
Start running.
Start running?
Yeah.
Really? If they're 18, start running?
Yeah. So I think that there are a couple of ways to look at this. I know that I'm a better politician for the life and career that I had before I got here. Mm. And I'm also, so I'm saying two things that are completely contradictory, by the way, just to be transparent about that. And at the same time, the House of Representatives should be representative of the population. And at the moment, it isn't. I mean, I'm delighted to have Chloe Swarbrick. She brings mm-hmm. our average down. But, you know, one 23-year-old out of 120 is not representative of the population. And I have to say that, I mean, she is a very unusual character, right? I mean, she's a remarkable woman. And she's running rings around members of parliament who are two or even three times older than she is. And so I guess she's had some life experience. She's founded three businesses. You know, she ran for mayor. You know, she's this is what I mean about her being remarkable. But, you know, for someone who's been around longer, actually she's, you know, got that kind of innate talent. So I think if someone is interested in politics, that you've got to make your own judgment call, I guess is what I'm saying, about when you think it's appropriate. But I also think, you know, it's a incredibly unpredictable career path. 90% of people who try to get into politics don't, right? If you think about it, so my electorate, Wellington Central, every election campaign, it generally has about 10 to 12 candidates who are running, of whom one becomes the Member of Parliament for that. Mm. And at the moment, there are two other candidates who are list MPs, myself and Nicola Willis, both ran in Wellington Central. So Wellington Central's sort of slightly overrepresented. We've got three members of parliament, you know. But, you know, the other people aren't.
They're gone.
They're not there. And so, you know, you just don't know. You can say, I want to get into politics, isn't the same as actually getting into politics. And you've got to give it a few shoves at the door. I mean, I got in on my third attempt. I ran in 2008, 2011, No, fourth attempt. 2008, 2011, 2014. Oh, yeah. No, sorry. I got in 2014. So, yeah. So I got in on my third attempt. And that was after basically 10 years of kind of working on it. So, you know, if you say to an 18-year-old, do you want to get into politics? The answer is yes, but you might be 28 before you actually get in.
So yeah. If someone is looking to get into politics, what are the steps they need to take? Like that first step to open that door?
Well, I mean, and it depends what level you're interested in. So I think we overlook local government as a valid area for people to be engaged in. One of the things I keep saying to Green Party people, though, is, look, if you want to do any of the things that we're interested in, actually local government is in some ways more important than central government, right? Because, you know, if you're interested in transport, well, you know, guess who deals with that? It's local government. If you're interested in clean water, you know, who regulates that? Local government. If you're interested in, you know, kind of parks and green spaces and all that, and, you know, rubbish collection and waste management and so on, local government. So in local government, it's a slightly different answer, because generally political parties don't have much of a presence there. It's mostly people running independent tickets. And so the first thing I would do is, if I was interested in that, is get a crew together, about half a dozen people who are prepared to work really, really hard for no money at all, on evenings and weekends. Find someone who is experienced, who can tell you how an election campaign runs and is put together, and just give it a crack. If you're interested in central government, then that is dominated entirely by political parties, and so the first thing to do would be to have a think about, which political party do you feel closest to? And I have to say, you will not agree with any one political party about everything. You know, I mean, I kind of joke that I agree and disagree with the Green Party in roughly equal proportions, and I'm one of the leaders of it, right? And that would probably be true of anybody really, and so about any political party, and so it's about the core philosophy of that party, not any one policy, but right, what are the kind of core values and principles, and do those resonate with me? And then generally, I'd sort of show up and say, how can I help?
And what do you think are the top three characteristics or values that a politician or aspiring politician needs to have?
Still to come in part two of my conversation with the Honourable James Shaw.
Come to work each day willing to be fired? I have to say, I always struggle with that question.
What do you procrastinate about?
I got my full driver's license last week.
What?
Yeah, I procrastinated about that for 25 years.
The Mountain Climbers Podcast continues next.